A passage in which a promise is fulfilled, isn't it? A promise that was made about 1900 years earlier. That's how long the world had had to remain. God had wait for this promise to be fulfilled. God is a long-term God. A promise that had been made in chapter 12, you'll have guessed, I'm sure already, of Genesis. At a point where the world was in a pretty dark place, we'd had 11 chapters, of effectively fall stories. We think of Adam and Eve, but then there's Cain and Abel. Then we have Noah and the flood, and everyone thinks, oh, that's a wonderful story of Noah and the flood. But actually, as soon as God restored the earth and blessed Noah and his family, what was the first thing Noah did? He got blind drunk. Not the first thing. He grew the grapes first. Then he got blind drunk, and in his embarrassment of being discovered, he promptly reversed God's blessing and cursed a third of the world's population, one of his sons and all his descendants. And so things carried on getting from bad to worse. Until one day, there's this Iraqi economic migrant called Abram. And he's minding his own business, looking after the camels or whatever you generally do on a Sunday morning. And God, a God, he doesn't know who, speaks and says to him, Abram, leave this place and leave your father's family. That's the more dramatic thing. And go to wherever I'll show you. And God promises three things. Firstly, I will bless you. That's in the center, and therefore that's the key thing. I will bless you. I will make you a great nation. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. You know that passage, don't you? Genesis 12, 1 to 3. A great promise. And really, the whole of the Old Testament then is about, you could say, the fulfillment of the first part of that. That I will make you a great nation. And a story really of discipleship. Remember that, as I said, Abraham, who we know as Abraham, didn't know this God. Joshua says later that his father, Abraham's father, Terah, worshipped other gods. This was a new God to them. And so the whole of the Old Testament is stories of discipleship as the people of Israel come about and learn who this God is, learn through experience what he expects of them, and how this God will relate to them in a totally different way from all the other gods around in the other nations. And learn slowly that this God is not a local God, but God of the whole world. He's not a God with a particular purpose like fertility. Lots of the gods were about fertility. Surprise, surprise. But God of everything. And we read this history throughout the whole of the Old Testament, didn't we? Of God revealing himself to this people, Israel. And God creating a nation for himself. But the other part of that promise, of all peoples on earth being blessed, seems to have gone away. It almost seems to be forgotten for much of the Old Testament. And the point where it really comes alive again is actually during the exile. When Isaiah starts preaching, encouraging the people, yes, God says, I will return you to your land. But there's more in Isaiah's prophecies. There's stuff about the Gentiles. There's stuff particularly to the servant of the Lord. Passages like this, where God says to his servant, it's too small a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. That word, a light to the Gentiles, recurs a couple of times in Isaiah and was, of course, then picked up by Simeon, talking of Jesus. And then Jesus comes, and again his ministry is actually to the people of Israel. ministry still focused on God's people. Until the turning point of his death on the cross and resurrection, and John's Gospel in particular, of course, had talked about his death on the cross being for the whole world, because God loved the whole world. And after his resurrection, Jesus gives his disciples commands, makes a promise in a sense. I'll take the one at the beginning of Acts, where he says, "You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in Judea, in Samaria, and to the ends of the earth." Doesn't he? And we see the beginning of that with Pentecost and the growth of the church. But again, this church is just in Jerusalem. It's just amongst the Jews. It doesn't seem to be happening. And yet the church is growing, and it's a wonderful time, and many people are being added to their number. Until this chapter that we just read. And in a way, the first verse of that is one of the key verses of the whole of Acts. I'm sure you spotted that. And yet, it seems to be a reversal. Because it says, on that day, a great persecution broke out against the church at Jerusalem. And all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. The church in Jerusalem at this point breaks out. And we're going to look into Acts 8 at three things. We're going to look at how the gospel spread. We're going to look a little at how it was preached. And then we're going to look a bit at the story of this one man, Philip. It struck me as we were reading, actually, we don't have, as Richard said, Philip in duplicate this morning. We have Philip in triplicate, because he's the subject of the passage as well. But how did the gospel spread? Because it did at this point. From this moment of apparent reversal, where the church, which had been flourishing, gaining respect, gaining believers, suddenly is under persecution. And it says Saul began to destroy the church. And yet, as these believers went out, and they were only new believers, and they were already discovering that belief in Jesus could be really costly. It could cost one of their friends his life, Stephen. It could cost them their homes and their safety. And they fled. And if they fled in fear. And yet, wherever they went, they proclaimed the gospel. And it wasn't just Judea. Philip makes this big leap, culturally, big leap, into Samaria, bringing the gospel there. And it wasn't just there either. If you go to the end of Acts 11, let's find it. Acts 11, verse 19. You'll find that, again, it's the people who fled from Jerusalem, who went down to Antioch, some of them, and started to proclaim the gospel to the Gentiles. Now, we make a big thing about Peter and Cornelius, Peter being dragged by the Lord to preach the gospel to one Gentile and his family. But here, people who didn't know what Peter was doing, they just fled, has started to found a church, a Gentile church in Antioch. That church then became the first missionary sending church, sending out Paul and Barnabas. That's the beginning of Acts 13, if you want to look. You see the story, the whole big story of God's mission beginning to unfold. And I love the fact that the key way that the gospel started to spread and God started to fulfill this promise to Abraham of blessing all the peoples of the earth through him was through an apparent setback, a disaster, where everyone is forced to flee and the church is being destroyed. And time and again, God has worked that way. The story of the church in China is well known, isn't it? That the missionaries were forced to leave China, and nothing was heard of the church, the young church, for years. And yet when people began to go back in and they discovered that his young church had grown amidst persecution. Less well known to you, perhaps, is the story of the church in Nepal. I was hearing about it a couple of months ago from a couple of Nepali pastors. That in the 1970s, the church was very small, based around Kathmandu in Nepal. And there was a measure of, it wasn't active persecution, but there was a measure of repression. If you were baptized, you faced a year imprisonment. That was a law that was brought in. And if a pastor baptized people, he faced 6 years imprisonment, designed to stop the church growing. And yet people still came for baptism, and as their fellows saw them coming for baptism, they said, if someone's willing to take that risk, there must be something about this church, about this religion. And so the numbers multiplied. And it was in that period that the church in Nepal spread throughout the country. God at work, in a sense, making use of man's attempts to stop him. The gospel threat spread through diaspora, through persecution. It spread through God sending individuals like Philip. We'll come back to his story later on. And it spread too, and this is implicit throughout Acts, and not stated so much, so we can focus too much on the individuals like Paul and Barnabas and Philip. It spread through those local churches just starting to grow, often planted, and then Paul or whoever it was had to leave after a few weeks. Same here, actually, with Philip and Samaria. We'll come back to that. But the local congregation, seeking to be faithful, seeking to be witness, clearly being different, and so the church growing. God working to grow his church through a variety of ways. And as I read this, I reflected on my own church, where I am, which has been growing, and we're wondering what's next for us as we grow, and how we should seek to spread the gospel in Abingdon, where I am. And I wondered, we look at ways of growing the church, but it's sometimes one of the ways that in a sense we should die, as happened to the church in Jerusalem. Without that dying, not totally, but being significantly reduced to the church in Jerusalem, the church would not have spread. The gospel would not have spread. Is it that we should be willing to let some of our talented people go elsewhere? It was a sacrifice for the church in Antioch. Paul and Barnabas were there preaching, teaching, building that church up. So for them to send their two key leaders, or two of their key leaders, out to go elsewhere was a sacrifice. And yet a church in Antioch recurs now and again, continued clearly to grow. Is that a way that we as a church are called to work and spread the gospel? I don't know your face here. I know you've planted a church already elsewhere in Birmingham. And what you're thinking about in the way you should grow. But these ways that God sometimes works are contrary to the way that we would naturally work, aren't they? And so they challenge us to be willing to make sacrifice as individuals, as a church, in order that the gospel, the kingdom, may grow. Never mind our church, but in order that the kingdom may grow. How was the gospel preached? We're going to have a couple of examples of how the gospel was preached in this passage. But just before I go into that, I was doing some training a couple of weeks ago for some people preparing to go overseas in mission. I think they were all going to go. Yes, they were all going to go overseas. We send people in UK as well. It's important, of course, to see UK as a mission field, just as much as overseas. And I said to them, let's imagine you're in a new place, and all you know about this culture is two things. One, they're not individualistic. This is a community culture. And in community cultures, that means, you know, individual guilt is less of an issue than shame in front of the community. That's the first thing you know. The other thing you know is that this is a culture where they are strongly aware of the spiritual world. So that's very different from our culture. And strongly sense being under the power of ancestral spirits. So, if you were there, how would you preach the gospel? Let's assume we haven't got linguistic difficulties. That's another thing. You're in a different culture which has different presuppositions from your own. How do you preach the gospel? And it's very interesting. They came back. The main thing they talked about was a God of love. Fair enough. That is one of our central beliefs, isn't it? God so loved the world. But I had to say to them, I don't think you've addressed the culture. And often it may be that what those people need to hear is that Jesus is more powerful than the spirits to which you are enslaved. One of the ways that Jesus said he was bringing the kingdom of God, and he specifically said this in response to John's doubts, was that he was casting out demons, overthrowing the power of Satan. So the gospel needs to be preached truly, not adapted so that it's not true, but preached in a way that addresses the questions of wherever we are. And to me, one of the glorious things of what we believe, of our gospel, is that it does speak to the questions of all peoples in all situations and from whatever starting point, whatever culture and economic position, whatever their position they're starting from. And so Philip had two opportunities in the passages we read. He spoke with a eunuch who'd come from Jerusalem, who was a worshipper, in some sense, of the true God, but clearly hadn't a clue what the full beliefs were as he struggled with this passage in Isaiah. And so at that point, he started from their common ground of Scripture and sought to explain it. But you see, when he went to Samaria, he preached the gospel and he was casting out demons. He was healing and casting out demons. And it becomes clear from the following passage with Simon the sorcerer that actually the main thing that they needed to see, or one of the main things, was that this Jesus whom Philip proclaimed was more powerful than their local sorcerer, whom they had started to think might be the great power. We heard from Rachel about a way that in a strongly Muslim country where seeking to convert people is illegal, I think. Yeah, pretty much. And certainly can lead you into trouble. So the church has found other ways of serving and gaining credibility for the gospel through that way. One of our people, her name is Pam, she works in a North African country where strongly Muslim society, where it is not allowed to go out and convert people and to preach on the streets or do anything evangelistic. That's illegal. But Pam just started to get to know her neighbours, and one day one of the neighbours collapsed in the street and went into a deep coma, and Pam knew enough about medical things to realise that this was very serious. And all the other women, this was a woman who collapsed, were around and not knowing what to do. And Pam said, and they knew she was, well, they knew she was foreign, obviously. They knew she was Christian. They said, do you mind if I pray for her? And they said, yes, anything. So Pam prayed. And this woman started to come back to consciousness. After about 20 minutes, she was back to full consciousness. And as a result, she had a group of women coming round saying, can we read the Bible with you? Can we learn about your God? Let me speak of another missionary, Cyprian. Cyprian was a youth worker, and he was sent to do youth work in another country. And he soon realized that actually this was going to be worthless unless he did family work. Because you see, Cyprian was Kenyan, and he was sent to an estate in Manchester. where there's no understanding, no background in the gospel for most people, completely unchurched, and where the issue wasn't youth, as the local churches had thought, it was family and family breakdown, community breakdown. And that's where Cyprian started. And he said to me about a year ago, I've been there 6 years now. I think I'm now getting the credibility to be involved at a deeper level in, for instance, mediation, where the community's broken apart. It's taking that long-term commitment and that long-term witness living in the midst of that community, gaining him the credibility to preach and to get involved at a different level. And cross-cultural preaching is risky and can be difficult and hard work. And yet we see God opening doors for people to bring the gospel across cultures. And we see, through our experience, the importance of people coming in or going out to preach and bring the gospel in a different way from the way the local community, the local Christian community, was able to do it and have an effect. And that's part of the value of people going and doing cross-cultural ministry. You could bring a different perspective, different priorities from the church. Jenny went out to Southwest Uganda, and the church there wasn't interested in children, not at all. Till she said to the bishop, look, can I start up a ministry for children? They're being neglected. He said, well, if you really want to, you can do it in your spare time. But your main job is vicar of the cathedral. She now has a thriving Sunday school ministry going. She moved on to youth. She's moved on to street kids. This is something that the Christians weren't doing, but the church now has a new witness to a whole group of people. And in Uganda, under 15s are a huge number of the population who were not being served. So I started talking about individuals. Let's look at how God used this individual, Philip. We've looked a little at how the church grew, the gospel grew, and some of the challenge that presents for us. Different ways that the gospel needs to be presented. A standard European way of presenting the gospel doesn't hack it in a non-European culture. It's really important we understand that. How did God use this one person, Philip? One of the exciting things for me when I'm involved in mission work is seeing people who thought their gifting and their profession was in one direction, and God sends them elsewhere, living outside their comfort zone, and they end up with a totally different ministry as God leads them. So exciting. I'll come back to a couple of stories, but let's look at Philip first. We'll start with the Bible. And Philip had started off in the church. Well, he was doing aid distribution, wasn't he? They got this aid the church was bringing together for widows. And those who were of a Greek background were feeling pushed out and neglected compared with those of a strictly Jewish, Israelite background. So they created this group of seven, among them Philip, to distribute it fairly. Clearly he was reliable. Clearly he was trustworthy. There's nothing here about him being a preacher. That wasn't his job. And yet with being forced to flee, he starts a different ministry of preaching and has the excitement of seeing his message believed, has the excitement of seeing God working through him and people healed and demons cast out, and has the excitement of seeing a people with whom he'd probably had zero or very little contact before coming to believe in Jesus. And it's all going thrillingly well. And the church in Samaria is growing, and Peter and John have come down, and they said, yes, we'll put the stamp of approval on. It's going well. This is what should happen. And God suddenly speaks to Philip and says, do something stupid for me. Have you ever thought how utterly ridiculous it was for God to say to Philip, go out onto the desert road to Gaza, not Ghana. Other people have been sent to Ghana. He had a thriving ministry, which he was going to have to leave, just as the church was starting. Take that risk. To go down to that road, he had to go back to the place he just fled from. You had to go past Jerusalem. Not sensible. And how many people was he going to find on a desert road to preach the gospel to? But Philip obeyed. And as he trudged along, and it must have been on the, at least the second, probably the third day of walking, and he must have been trudging along in the hot sun thinking, why? I'm sure he's far too obedient to think why. I would have thought why, right? I would have said why. Wouldn't you? What am I doing here? One chariot comes along with one bloke in it sitting reading. And the Spirit says to Philip, that's him. That's why you're on this road. And Philip explains the gospel to the eunuch. The eunuch believes and goes on his way rejoicing, and we know nothing more. Philip knew nothing more. It says the eunuch didn't see Philip again. Philip didn't see the eunuch again. He knows nothing more of why God wanted to do that. It's one of those tantalizing moments in Scripture. And part of mission is not knowing what God's doing with you. And yet there was something about that encounter that when Philip landed, as it were, the Spirit picked him up and put him down in Azotus, which was on the coast in Philistia, so we're outside Jewish territory again. He carried on preaching the gospel. And he just moved from town to town, preaching the gospel until he came to Caesarea, and then he settled. And years later, and this is in Acts 21:8, Paul comes across him, and in Caesarea, Philip, who's sometimes known as Philip the Deacon, isn't known as Philip the Deacon at all. He's known as Philip the Evangelist, because he's been there long term with his family preaching the gospel. And it's exciting when you see God taking someone like that on a journey of obedience in totally unexpected directions. Take Michael. He's one of our people working in Jordan, and you support him. And Michael is a disabilities nurse. That's what he went out for. And I remember him saying to me 2 years ago, maybe only a year ago, so, you know, Philip, frankly, I could be with the UN doing this job. Why am I doing this as a mission partner? Why are you bothering to have me in this role? And I said to him, because when I listen to your stories, Michael, you're not just being a disabilities nurse. You're getting into homes. You're drinking coffee with them. He said, actually, most of what I do is drink coffee, which is fine by Michael. But that's what you do in the culture. You don't go in and just look at the patient and off you go. You sit and drink coffee. And you're having conversations as a Christian with these people and just opening up the odd opening. And he told stories of one or two people who'd come to him because they knew he's a Christian and opportunities he's had for the gospel. But now, he wasn't convinced at that point, and he went through a period of really thinking, what was he doing? And struggling, and then there were struggles at work, and it just didn't seem to be working. And now God's opened up a new avenue of work for him, totally unexpected. But it's working with exploited foreign workers in Jordan. You know, a lot's come from further east, from South Asia and from Southeast Asia to the Middle East and get exploited there. And Michael and a colleague have started working amongst some of those who are exploited and who flee from the families that have been abusing them. And a new ministry is opening up, totally unexpected. Not his skill set, not his background, but for the way God is taking him. Pamela was in Japan as a teacher. She's recently retired. Pam was in Japan, get this, for 41 years. Japan, you need to be there a long time. Totally different culture. Westerners, not really accepted, quite difficult. Christianity, tiny. It's still only 1% of the population. And she was there as a teacher for over 30 years before they said, do you know, we'd like you to be ordained in the Japanese church and be much more involved in ministry. And the church where she is ministering is one of the few in Japan that has been growing. and where the work of the Holy Spirit is strongly evident. Again, very exciting. God working in different ways, short-term, long-term. People in some times have tried to put God in boxes to how we should do mission work. You know, should nothing less than 10 years. These days, a lot of people say, oh, well, I went on a two-week mission trip. Actually, God works in a huge variety of ways, and it's exciting to see him doing that. And all of this is moving towards that day where, which is envisaged in Revelation 7, where John sees, let's find it, let's read it. Revelation 7 verse 9, where John says, after this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb, wearing white robes and holding palm branches, and crying out with a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. That's what it's all moving towards. That's what this sending of people across the world, not only from Britain, not only from America, from Korea, from Brazil, from India, big sending country, India, and many other countries, this global movement that God is engendering and that is growing of people going to preach the gospel, short-term, long-term, as God leads and in the different ways that God leads. And that's what's so exciting. And we cannot say, that's out there and that's fine and it's great, but it's an add-on to what we do locally. No. The whole thing is, we are part of this. God promised to Abraham that through his seed, through Israel, through, of course, then Jesus, through those who believe, the whole world will be blessed. And he will create a whole church. And we'll be looking more this evening about this sense of unity, this worldwide, multicultural church that God is creating and is growing. How excited are you by Revelation 7? How excited are you when you read those words about every nation, people from every nation, every tribe, every culture, every tongue? They weren't worshiping in English. Sorry, guys, but they weren't. Gathered together and worshiping God. How excited are you to learn from people of other cultures who've asked other different questions of this gospel and found God speaking, and from whom therefore we can learn and have our understanding of God and of the gospel and of the Christian life broadened? I tell you, you haven't fully appreciated the nativity story until you've seen it acted out by people who've lived under oppression, and they bring out wholly different aspects of it. That's what we're part of. That's what happened, what started here in Acts. And in Acts 8, Acts 11, of the gospel going out from one being one local religion to the whole world. How does God want us to be part of it? How does God want you as a church, as an individual, to be part of it? Is there a part of the world that he wants you really to commit yourself to pray for? Not just on Sunday, really to be finding out about and getting passionate about and praying for. Is there one of your mission partners, and whether in UK, in Birmingham, overseas, he wants you really to be supporting? Could it be that he's even saying to you, go somewhere different. Do something different. Do something that may seem lunatic and stupid to your family, your friends, and may even and to you some of the time when things go badly and you have doubts, and it will do for me. What is God saying to us? What does God want to say to us through the life of Philip, through this passage in Acts, through the whole story of his mission story here in the Bible? That's what it is. It's a mission, a worldwide mission story. That's how we must understand it. Moving towards this wonderful moment where people from every nation, tribe, people, and language and culture stand together as one praising God, worshiping him. It's a wonderful vision, isn't it? Let's find ways to be more and more part of it. Let's pray.